I think it would be far less complicated if you had that dipole located in your attic rather than attached to your vertical.
Okay, how about if I just threw a single wire up in my neighbor's yard about 65 feet, and it would only be a single dipole.
Okay, I think we're getting the terminology confused. A dipole, by definition, is something with two legs. So you can have a center-fed dipole with two equal legs, or you can have an off-center dipole with one leg longer than the other, or you can have a totally different thing that's called an end set, which is a single wire going out going out as far as you can make it. The higher the better. End feds come in two varieties. There are resident half-wave end feds, so those are designed specifically to be a half a wavelength of the lowest frequency if you're interested in using. That requires a impedance transformer, something like a 49 or a 64 to 1 transformer. If you're just using a random non-resonant end-fed line, usually people get a 9-to-1 unun to transform the impedance to a lesser degree and then run through an antenna tuner. So theoretically, you can do that. There are end-feds available that have the unun built to you. You could get a kit. I think ARRL sells a kit. There are a whole bunch of different places. You can even find instructions on the internet of building your own transforming unun. Elevation is very important. If you can't get it elevated to more than a half a wavelength above the ground, you're going to get the best local conversation. It's not going to reach as far away as you might want to.
Okay, thank you very much. Your transmission was halfway blocked by someone else, but I got the half-wave dipole in my antenna being better than anything else that my options provide.
Okay, well, it's a shame that someone's playing around in the background. There's a lot of choices out there. The standard is, and what a lot of people start with, is a half-wave dipole cut to the frequency that you like to use. It has a reasonably good bandwidth for that band. So in other words, if you want to do 20 meters or 20 to 40 meters, you can cut it to the middle or the portion that you like to use. If you're not interested in doing CW or digital, you might be more interested in the phone section. And, it takes two attachment sites for either end and one for the center feed point get an RF choke so that you don't get any radio frequency getting into your shack and screwing around with your equipment. Like I said, there are half-wave end feds, there are off-center dipoles available, there are a lot of different designs.
For IWS to win. You made it 100%, so it was probably a Dave then.
Oh, okay, Dave, you're probably very far from the repeater. You're not full quieting as far as I hear. So, you're about 40% noise. If you're able to change your position closer to, say, a window, if the antenna is on the inside, or if you can boost the power output, that'll improve your transmission. Unfortunately, the power increase is going to help you receive my signal any better, but if you're operating with something like a handy talkie that has a whip, the closer it is to the window, usually the better. Some people go outside and stand on a slight elevation, that usually helps.
Okay, AD2ZQY. But I completely understood your conversation, and I appreciate the advice, and I will look into a higher fed dipole antenna.
Okay, very good. As I mentioned, usually you're trying to look for about an elevation of about half of a wavelength distance from the ground. So, you know, if your roof is half a wavelength above the ground, then that counts. When we're talking ground, we're talking earth ground. We're not talking about roof. So, yeah, elevation is a good thing to a degree. You want to get it at least a half of a wavelength off of the ground to give you a better takeoff angle so your radio waves travel to the horizon and skip along the ionosphere, and that's what gives us good propagation and more distant contact.
Okay, thank you very much. My next question would be, can I run a dipole and a vertical on the same mast?
Yes, you can, but you would probably want to, you can hang a inverted V on your mast, and you can place a vertical at the top of the mast. I would not use the vertical itself structurally for hanging the dipole. I would use the lower portion of the mast to hang the dipole and the end of the mast for mounting the vertical.
Okay, would that be approximately like 8 to 10 feet off the ground?
Well, again, you got the problem. If you have an inverted V and you need it to be about a half of a wavelength, and you say you're operating at 20 meters, so 20 meters, half of a wavelength is 10 meters. 10 meters is approximately 30 feet, 35 feet. So if it was only 6 to 7 feet, you'd get a lot of absorption on the ground and a lot of reflection going straight up into the sky. So your takeoff angle is what people sometimes call cloud warmers, because they warm the clouds, they warm the earthworms in the ground, but they don't really get out. So for a vertical, you would have to have something that at least the center portion of the inverted V should be elevated at least half of a wavelength above the ground.
Half a wavelength as opposed to my anticipated frequency.
Half a wavelength of the frequency you want to operate on. So in other words, if it's something simple like we mentioned earlier, 10 meters, half a wavelength above 10 meters is 5 meters. Again, 5 meters is approximately 16, 17 feet. It's a lot easier to do 16 or 17 feet, so it's a lot easier to have a dipole for 10 meters that radiates out into the horizon, whereas if you upscale it to a 40-meter dipole, 40 meters, half of a wavelength would be 20 meters, and it would be about 65 feet off the ground, which is much more difficult to do. So verticals can exist much closer to the ground. The only problem with verticals is if you put it straight on the ground, you need a lot more radials to block its coupling from the ground. So, but you know, putting a vertical up by about 10 feet, you don't need that many radials, and you won't have that much ground loss. Whereas with a dipole, a horizontally oriented dipole, as you go up in the wavelength, you need more and more elevation.
Is that a ship?
Yes, Wesley.
very much. I'm new at this, and I believe I followed what you just said. But thank you very much.
You're welcome, Dave. The TechNet's here every Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock, as I mentioned. And you're always welcome. If you have any further questions, you know where to find us. Wesley, you wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, it seems to me the conversion, I was in another room, maybe I didn't see it properly. Did you say 5 meters 6 feet? Or I heard it wrong. 15 feet.
Now, Wesley, you heard it wrong. It's basically a little over 3 times the meters or the feet. So you heard it wrong. I was going through a whole bunch of different lengths, by the way. Yes, Sam, what can I do you for? It's not the higher the better. You basically have to design depending upon your situation. The point that I try and give people an explanation of what's going on with a resonant half wave end set is you should think of it as a center fed at first. So a center fed half wave has a feed point of about 72 ohms. That's the lowest impedance across the antenna. As you slide the feed point towards one of the ends, the edges, the impedance goes higher and higher. And theoretically, if you take it to the very, very, very end, it should have an input impedance of infinity. It doesn't because we don't live in a theoretical world, and there's always some virtual length of extra conductor and capacitive coupling going on at the edge. So approximately somewhere between 2,000 to 3,000 ohms is the impedance of a half-wave resonant end-set. You want to feed it into a transmitter, tuner and a transmitter, that would like to get a 50-ohm impedance signal. That's the way it was designed, and that's the only way it's really going to work well. If you directly insert a 2 or 3,000 ohm impedance into your transmitter, it will reflect most of it back to the transmitter, which will then cut its power to a very low amount to spare the circuitry from burning out. So what you need is to have something that will change the impedance transformer. So some people use a 7-to-1 winding ratio, so the impedance transformation is 7 times 7, which is 49. Some people use a 8-to-1, which is a 64 translation. So approximately, if your impedance is about 2,000 and you use a 49-to-1 transformer, it brings it very close down to the 50 ohm situation. So you have to get the unowned transformer that suits the purposes and the impedances that it's going to be operating on. There are a whole bunch of different ways. I have, again, it's another article that hopefully in the fall you'll be able to read. It'll be in the newsletter. You can simulate it on a computer simulation, or you can build one. out and then put a VNA on it and measure the impedance at that V point. You know, it's all kind of been done over and over and over before, so most people know that if they choose to have a half wave, specifically a half wave end set, so in other words, if you want to operate at 40 meters, then you get a 20 meter piece of wire and feed it at one end as an end set, so you know that you're either going to get use a 49 to 1 or a 64 to 1. That's kind of the way everyone rolls. Most people use a 49 to 1.
Okay. Now, can we just jump through it on the show? The last question, real quick. If you just let it be, okay, I'm going to where is the signal coming at the highest point, like if I got 40 foot pole? Is it coming at the highest point, or is it coming at the lowest point? Why is it like that?
Okay, the reason why everyone talks about an inverted V versus a V is because most of the current in a dipole is present closer to the center V. In other words, the voltage maximum are at the edges, the current maximum is at the V point. So it's not all at the V point, but it peaks at the V point and goes down to zero at the edges. So it's the center portion that's the most important to be elevated as opposed to the edges.
Okay, so if I'm going up 40 feet, I can hold to, I can spend time with the signal up there, and I can still get some energy down.
Yes. Just with inverted Vs, make sure that the angle that the two elements make is at least 90 degrees. If you don't, it will impact on the efficiency of the antenna. So, you know, you can have it at 90, you can have it at 100, you can have it at 120 degrees, but don't let it go to 80 degrees or 70 degrees. You know, if you let this two sides droop too much, it will impact on the ability for it to work out.
Oh, I got you. Yeah,
you're welcome, Sam, anytime. You know where we are, you know where to find us.
No, I just can't catch your show on Sunday. So the soon as I get into the radio, you know, the hands up. My sister's got the hand, I can pick it up. All right, thank you.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing you on the 10-meter net one of these days. Yeah, you're going to need a 10-meter radio that's capable of single sideband transmission and reception.
Okay, yeah, I have 10-meter on this. Like I said, this left, this day to have it, and I'll ask for all the content, because they don't make on this radio. If I do what I do now, I will have a voice. Yes, I will be back. I will be back.
Okay, I look forward to it, Sam. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Limewire Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments today, let me tell you my little story before we go off on hopefully an interesting tangent. I am, we talked about it in the past, I own iPhones and iPads, but I don't have Macs and computers. I decided it's Intel and Windows and such, which may or may not have been a good idea, but nevertheless. So I have an old iPhone. It's a 6 Pro. I have lots of problems with the batteries. Eventually, they fail. They swell up, and they poke out of the front of the iPhone, and I usually send it back and have it replaced. And this time I tried to do that, and they said, nah, we can't fix your phone. So I called them up. I did that through the web page. I called them up, and, you know, Apple's very polite, very pleasant, very useless. And they said, yeah, I think it's a 14-year-old phone. We don't stock batteries for 14-year-old phones. Let me drop this in. So they told me that I could go to a store and ask around, and I kind of whined and complained that Apple is a multi-billion-dollar company. It's a computer company, and they don't have a list of inventory for battery parts at their stores. So the pleasant person, who was somewhat useless, offered to make some calls and came back and told me that Micro Warehouse does replace the battery, but doesn't stock the battery, so I would have to leave them the phone for a month. They would order the battery at their leisure and repair the cell phone at their leisure, and they approximately estimate 1 month's delay. So I thanked her very much and got on my computer and went to iFixit, which sells the battery and the tools to pop out the proprietary screws of an iPhone. Took me 10 minutes, and I swapped the batteries, and it's working very nicely. It's probably not quite as waterproof as it once was, because they did seem to have the blue seal that makes it a little bit more waterproof. But still, I don't really use it outside. It's my spare iPhone that's not really hooked up to the telephone network. I just use it as a little mini computer. So, the moral of the story is, if something goes to bluey with your battery and you don't want to go around Apple's nonsense, for a good $30, you can buy a replacement battery and all the parts necessary to fix it. So that's my little moral of that story.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Are they lithium ion or are they nickel metal hydride? You know, what was happening when these things were banned?
Now, these are all lithium ion. It's been lithium ion since, I think, the very first iPhone. It's just, its smart charger is not terribly smart. I have this very bad habit. I leave my phone sitting on their charger base. And that's probably not a good idea. Now, theoretically, if the charging chip was really smart, which it's supposed to be, it would sort of know when to top off my battery and when not to force topping it off repeatedly. But it doesn't seem to be that smart. So it's just a standard lithium-ion battery. But if you charge it constantly, it overheats, and the material generates too much gas that it can't dissipate, and it's like a balloon. It just kind of blows up. Not boom blows up, but expands blows up.
I wondered why I actually stick with wireless charging. 8202.
Well, for the 6 Pro, there was no option for that. I'm doing my own little experiment. I have a 13, which is wireless charging, and I leave it on its wireless charger, and I'll report back whether or not I ever have expanding batteries for that one as well.
FYI, I do have a question in mind for my own needs, but we'll come back to that. Well, for mine, I typically leave my phone on the wireless charger, and my question to you is, if you're going to do wireless charging, doesn't the charger typically shut off once it gets to 100?
Well, hopefully it does that. The problem is, and theoretically on a wire charger, it sort of should do that as well. That's the whole idea why it's not called a supercharger. It's supposed to be called a smart charger. But apparently not. There is some limitation of its intelligence when it comes to wire. Now, whether or not that's duplicated in the design for the wireless models, I won't be able to tell you until I've had a good long chance to test it. I've had my 13 for less than a year. I think it came out in September or October. That's when I bought it. I've had it kind of sitting on a wireless charger when I don't use it. And so far the battery's been fine, but I haven't had any problems with batteries until they kind of get to be about 2 years old. And that's where it starts to swell up on me. So I don't know yet, but again, I'll report back. I would use wireless if I had the option, but way back 14 years ago when the 6 Pro came out, I don't even think Androids that were capable of wireless charging.
I picked up a dual wireless charger a couple of weeks ago, and I immediately stopped using it because both phones were charged ridiculously slowly. It would say like 2 hours for like 50%, but it should really be like maybe an hour and 20 minutes at most at that, and then maybe like, I don't know, 30 minutes at 70%, so I ended up not using it. So the single charger charges much faster. Now, here's something you may want to look closely at. On the battery symbol on your phone, I'm looking at mine right now, my phone's battery is 58%. When I plug it in, you get that little lightning symbol on it signifying that it's charging. Now, when it gets to 100%, it'll say the battery is charged, and that symbol, even if it's plugged into something, actually disappears. Sometimes what will happen, though, is when it gets to 100, that little symbol will stay there as if it were still charging, too. You'd have to unplug it, and now it just went down to 57%.
Okay, one of the many problems is you're kind of believing something that isn't quite real. These 100% and 20% are approximations. Sometimes they're educated approximations, sometimes they're marketing approximations. The manufacturer can adjust their device to report anything as 100% and anything as 10 or 20%. So don't think that those numbers are etched in stone. Also, charge modes are a big headache. USB charge modes and wireless charge modes have different types and different speeds because they use different voltages and different currents. So there are ultra-fast, fast, and just regular wireless chargers, and there are USB handshaking protocols that boost the amount of power to charge up a battery. So there are USB chargers that charge things at different rates, and there are wireless chargers that charge them at different rates. Being a double charger is not the inherent limitation for the charge rate. It's more a factor of whatever chips and design they put into that. It simply is probably one of the oldest chips that handles less power.
Well, clearly you cannot charge it wired and wireless at the same time. I tried that once, and boy, it did not even work out. Like, nothing happened. It charged the same rating, and I'm like, yeah. I don't know who would do it this way, but you're wasting your time. Charge it one way, not both ways. So yeah, I stick with wireless charging when I'm just in my room, which is where I am now. Or if I'm out on the go, I use my battery pack to charge my phone if I need to. And you're going to laugh at me for this. I charge my phone when it gets down to 70% because I'm very, very picky.
Okay, I mean, theoretically, that accelerates the aging of the battery. Most people who talk about extending the life of a battery suggest that you keep it somewhere between 30 to 60%. That people who top things off tend to have a shorter lifespan with their battery than people who kind of leave it for somewhere in the middle. But I don't see any real purpose in both wired and wirelessly charging it, because it's not going to charge any particular faster as far as anyone is concerned. It's just more convenient. But then, usually it's more convenient to do it wirelessly, but it's more efficient to do it wired. So if you're concerned about saving energy for the world, you plug it in. If you're less concerned, you just put it on the wireless charger and let it go. And again, there are different generations of, they're all called, I think, Qi. That's the technology, QI or something, QI. Qi, it requires a degree of handshaking from the two devices, and then once it shakes hands and both of them know what kind of power protocols they accept, it negotiates the proper power protocol and charges at a given rate. And depending upon the design and the chipset, it can either be a very slow, low power charge or a less efficient but faster high power charge.
Even if I wanted to let my phone go all the way down, it's a little something that many people really believe you're supposed to let it actually die and then you recharge it. That is actually not true. That actually is another way that you can drain the battery out. What you really should do is not let it go below 10%. If the most, maybe 20%, around 20%. I would not let it go any lower than that. For those people that let their phone die and recharge it, sure, but that actually is one way to drain the battery. Don't do that. When it gets to like 25-20, throw it on the charger, get it back up to 80-90, and then unplug it. That's what I would do. And again, the majority of these, well, not again, I'm using the wrong word. The majority of these new phones, the battery is sealed, but you can't even get to it anymore. So if the battery really is worn out, then you have to pull the phone back. Pull the phone apart, take out the battery, and then switch it out, and then put the phone back together, or you're just going to have to get a new phone. So that's really how things are when it comes to technology these days.
Well, yes, Craig, but if you missed it, that's what was the beginning of this conversation, that my battery had gone bad, and I fixed it, and got a replacement battery and a couple of little tools, and because it had already popped to the front of the display, it was a lot easier to get into it because there's a glue rim around it. Then the battery itself is glued onto the chassis with these strange little tabs, these plastic strips of adhesive that stick very, very tightly at right angles, but if you grab the edge of the tab and you pull on them, they stretch very long length. Something that's about 6 inches long will be able to be stretched to be about 6 feet long, and when it stretches, it releases what it's glued to. So it loosens the battery. You can remove the battery rather easily, swap the connector, and put the glue strips on the new battery, and it works. Now, getting back to what you said, that's kind of from prehistory. In the olden days, generally used rechargeable batteries were nickel-cadmium. Nickel-cadmium had memory effect, so that is every time you discharged your battery to, say, 40 or 50% and then recharged them, after a while you could not use it below 50%. It developed the memory. That's not the case with lithium-ion, so you don't have to discharge them completely and recharge them, and I would agree with you. Totally discharging them, probably not a good thing for the battery. So get into the habit of recharging them when there's something like 20 or 30. But in order to actually calibrate your battery, because I had to do it again with the new battery, the instructions are that you should charge it fully and then for a couple hours, and then run it down all the way to the bottom where it turns itself off, and then recharge it up. That gives the smart chip a calibration to go on. So you shouldn't generally discharge it completely, but if you're swapping batteries, the first step you should do is calibrate the battery to the smart chip by running it down the first time.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, doing it once won't hurt it, but if you do it, like, hundreds and hundreds of times, then, yeah, you're going to cause damage. So, to everyone else listening, don't let your battery go down fully. Plug it in at least 10%, maybe a little higher. I would recommend 20%. And then let it go up to 80, 90, and then 100%. That's all I've got for this topic, and now I believe I would like to share my question to you when you are ready.
AC2CS. Okay, we'll do it in 1 second. I just want to point out, I don't know that much about Android. I haven't had that much experience. Apple iPhones actually have a feature where when there's about what it says is 20% capacity left, it flashes up a little screen and says, look, we only got 20%. So either turn the cell phone off or switch to save battery power mode. So it's at least that intelligent. You have to really want to run it all the way down. It's somewhat difficult. Anyway, I just wanted to add that. So go on to your next question, Craig.
This was just a question about the topic that you had in mind, and now it's time for my actual question. Wednesday night, when I was in Jamaica for work and I came back to Babylon, someone decided to snap one of my VHF-UHF antennas on the truck. And the antenna is still intact, but the top piece is missing. And I already ordered a new one to replace it, but this is kind of a silly question, but I'll ask you. Could you theoretically, because the antenna is in sections, could you theoretically remove the top part with those Allen keys and then find, like, a split piece from another VHF-UHF and attach it to that?
There's a lot. It's just a conductor, so you could strap a piece of aluminum and brace it next to the other element and cobble something together that works temporarily. You can replace a segment, especially if different segments are attached with little screws. You could simply go to someplace like Home Depot and see if they have some aluminum stock that would fit the barrel and cut it down to the proper size and replace that segment.
Well, here's the problem. My tri-bander antenna is currently in its place temporarily, and I can't really take anything from that and add it to a strictly VHF-UHF only antenna, because that antenna is actually a tri-bander because it works with 220 as well. So if I did that, then I would have to use 2 meter 440 only, or it wouldn't really be a match.
Again, probably the simplest thing is to just get some aluminum stock. You don't necessarily have to screw up a perfectly working antenna to kind of fix another antenna. You can just buy some aluminum stock, especially the way you describe it, it sounds like it's a set screw. So you just loosen the set screw, you pull out the remaining portion of the rod, and replace it with something that's the same length, and you should be good to go. I wouldn't risk damaging another antenna to save that one, unless there's something really special about it.
Just a question for thought, but I already dropped 150 on another antenna. Not actually for the antenna itself, but two of them, because now my 20-meter hamstick just snapped at its base. And that really made me angry, considering I just put my TS-40 SAT permanently in the car, and 20 meters worked perfectly up to 50 watts. I didn't really want to push it further, because I didn't want to see any indicator light come on, since I know a few friends have suffered very bad luck with that. I mean, I have my 40-meter antenna in its place. I haven't tested 40 yet. I'll probably do that tomorrow. I'm going to do it very slowly. 5 watts, 10, 25, 30, and then 50 maximum. I'm probably not going to go past 25. 25, because after what had happened to somebody, I don't want it to happen to myself. But I've got a single ground, really, through the antenna, and that's really all I need. But 20 meters up to 50 watts while moving works perfectly, even though I haven't really made a contact yet. KD2OGD.
Okay, let me just ask you a question. Why are your antennas snapping off? Is there some malicious individual who is assaulting your antennas?
So, when I checked, when I got back to Babylon, the 20-meter was intact. It was just the 2-meter 440 that was snapped from the top. Probably some idiot. And I have a feeling it's probably because of where I parked, considering that it might have been for them. And they were either just jealous or did not like where I parked and just chose to do that against me, which I thought it was just going to be a ticket, but I don't know who in their right mind would want to snap one of my antennas like that. So I will probably be parking in the correct place next time, so I don't really give them the idea to do that. But I don't think this was probably done on purpose. I think it was somebody that did this because of where I parked. Since, you know, actually, no, I'm not going to go into it, but I think it had to do with where I parked. That's probably why they did it.
Okay, you just might want to consider getting a magnetic base antenna so that you can take it off of your car and put it in your truck where no one can snap it.
Hold on a second, Roy.
IWS to N, that's what I used to do. I had a mag mount, throw it right in the trunk.
Yeah, we live in weird times. We kind of always have lived in weird times. You learned a whole bunch of things. Don't have the radio visible by the window. If at all possible, detach the radio, put it in the trunk, detach the antenna and put it in the trunk, because there's a lot of malicious, miserable people out there who want to share the misery. So, you know, I mean, there's nothing particularly special about an NMO mount. Mag mounts are fine, unless you're really concerned about scratching your paint job. But it makes for a very, very easy-to-police antenna. You know, they make them of very high quality.
Yeah, remember, the cars, all the cars, people used to snap the radio antennas off. Just, you don't see that anymore because there's no more outdoor antennas. Well, they have a little thing sticking out of the roof, and that's about it. Remember, you know, countless people would be riding around with coat hangers in their fences.
Ah, yes, the good old days. But now antennas are embedded into windshields. You know, you basically have to steal the windshield.
Modern technology saved the day. Very good. Let's see if Craig is back.
My radio is about to die. I'm going to switch over to Echolink on my phone.
Okay.
All right, I'm on Echolink via my phone, so it should be fine now.
Yep, I hear you good.
Yeah, because I don't know if the rest of my bowfin batteries are charged, so I'm like, yeah, whatever, I'll go to my phone. So, as much as how I would use a magnetic mount, I'd like to get one back on the roof again, but I just wanted to try something a little different with my antennas, but, and I guess I could see what Paul states to kind of unscrew the antenna, but why would I really do that? Because then that takes a few seconds out of my time, and I don't really want to do that. I just want to jump in the car and get out of there. I mean, I do spend at least 3 seconds inspecting the antennas. That's always the first thing I would do before getting in the car, to make sure that they haven't been tampered with. But when I got back to Babylon, it was the dual bander that was snapped. The 20 meter was still there, but then this afternoon when I got home, somehow it snapped out of space, probably because when I had to make an adjustment, I didn't realize before, it just somehow snapped out of space, and it could fall off in the wind, so I just took it off and threw it away, and I have a another one coming in a few days, plus my dual bander for my replacement, so I'm not really worried. And again, with what you said, Roy, in terms of attaching one antenna to another, you're better off just buying a new one. I mean, I could do that, but there's really no point in doing that, considering it's not really a fully matched antenna. So I'll keep the dual bander that broke for spare parts if I need it.
Doc, it's up to you. A lot of people kind of build their own antennas anyway, so replacing one element that snaps, you know, as long as there's no capacitors or inductors involved, just a length of metal is kind of easy to procure and simple to replace. Not quite sure what you meant earlier by unscrewing the antenna. If it's something like a magnetic mount, you just kind of pull it off of the hood, and you put it in the trunk, or you hide it under the seats, and it's a done deal. People have to break into your car to maliciously attack your antenna. They won't do that. So I'm not quite sure where the unscrewing is going on.
Okay. The antenna that I had for a dual bander was the Comet SFC-7. Now, it's already assembled in the box. However, using Allen keys at the section where those little, I guess those little 3-inch dividers are, you can unscrew those, you can unscrew those screws and literally take each section of the whip off and make the antenna smaller, or you can add more to the antenna. That's what I was trying to tell you. You can literally do that to any antenna that has those divider sections on it, or those spring parts, like in between the whip parts, rather than just one continuous whip, where if you take it off, then that's really it. You can't really add anything extra to it.
Okay, well, but, yeah, I mean, again, if it attaches, because I'm looking at a picture of it, it's not the greatest one, it looks like there's some kind of inductor or something connecting the final solid rod of aluminum, and, you know, if part of that aluminum broke off and there's an attachment to the screw for the inductor attaching to the end rod, you could just replace it with the same length and the diameter and operation just the same exact way, unless I'm missing something on this illustration.
Yeah, but I don't really want to do that with my tri-bander right now, since I'm just using it as a temporary fix. But yeah, I have the I have it coming in a few days, so I'm not worried. I'd rather just drop the money on a new one, but I figure I'd just ask the question, hey, can you theoretically add can you theoretically add something to an antenna, make it taller, get more gain or SWR out of it, or whatnot? So that was mainly my question. That's all I got for now. I'm going to scroll through my TS-480 book and see who's on my Discord. So thank you, Roy. ACQGS Net Control, 82OGD.
Okay, very good. Good luck with your new antennas. Hopefully they won't be snapping anymore. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Linemark Technical Desk. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments to make, please hit that push to call button with your first name and call sign. No questions, no comments, nothing out there. I'd have something out there. Yes, Leslie?
I'm not sure if you want to discuss the electric resonator antenna.
It's a bit esoteric, wouldn't you say?
Dielectric resonator antenna, Google.
Okay. It's a microwave type of antenna design. Not really used for most frequencies that have used.
Yeah, it's for microwave frequencies. It seems as if you had your radio wave base on the wavelength in the medium, so the electric becomes sort of the boundary for those frequencies, and when you use the wavelength that is emitted from the electric, you can actually make the sound for it. So it is used at higher frequency and is made from a ceramic material of various shapes. So the dielectric resonator is mounted on the metal surface, like a ground plane. The radio waves are introduced when we introduce the radio waves into the inside of the resonator material for the transmitter circuit. Then this frequency bounces back and forth between the resonator walls, forming standing waves. And the walls of the resonator are partially transparent to the radio waves, allowing the radio power to radiate into space. But actually, shortly how that is made. But it's a quite effective antenna that is working in frequencies of the best is 60 gigahertz and 20. Okay. A little bit about the history. In 1939, this antenna was proposed by Robert Rimchmer, I'm reading right now. In 1982, the first designer says of the electric resonator antennas are considering a leaky waveguide model atomic magnetic conductor model of the electric surface. So was its first investigation, and this kind of antenna is used often in mining, and that actually puzzled me because we're talking about using radio waves underground. I recall when I was in Morelli Gold Mine doing a job in Elko, Nevada. They had a leaky coaxial cable. They didn't use at this time yet those antennas, but right now it looks like mostly they moved to those antennas. So it looks like the open space in the mine is good enough for that high frequency to go into and probably bounce from the walls in the corners when we have the curvature of the tunnel. But interesting is that the operation of the electric antenna resembles antenna conceived by Marconi. The father, I mean, it used to be a father of radio waves till after his death and death of Tesla. The right to radio wave technology was given to Tesla already dead. So that's a few things about it. I'm not sure if it's too esoteric, but I can go further with that because it is also used in 5G technologies that try to go to unlicensed 60 gigahertz band. That's right here.
Well, I mean, yeah, the microwave is a good portion of the 5G bandwidth. A lot of that probably hasn't been quite realized It's sort of vaguely like a patch antenna, except it doesn't have the conductor on top. It has the ground plane. It has the dielectric, but it somehow operates without the patch part of the patch antenna.
Yeah, I guess so. I only recently got to the subject, but it's a quite interesting for me. The very short end antenna solutions were made from monopoles, dipoles, and patch antennas that were put in a certain geometric form. So those antennas are characterized by very small size, and they are very low weight, and it's extremely inexpensive. It's like a piece of plastic that you can use. And advanced solutions based on integration of those direct substrates uses lensing structure that was adopted to those antennas from reduced radiation efficiency and narrow impedance bandwidth due to the effect of lossy silicon substrate materials. So it's a new approach. So it looks like soon we're going to have a 5G at 60 gigahertz or higher in our cell phones. And so it's here.
Well, you know, one of the many problems with scaling up 5G is not only the technology, but the fact that the free space range of those transmissions are much shorter. So they're going to have to increase the number of cell facilities in order to make up for that that loss.
Yeah, it's a good point. I found another line. These antennas rely on radiating resonators that can transform guided waves into unguided waves, which is RF signal. So it looks like there is a straight path between waveguide, which is guided wave, right, into the RF signals that the waveguide that is connected to the transmitter. So imagine that we have a phone that has a waveguide that is made from the two-dimensional interface, which is actually two different pieces of plastic having different properties, directing properties, and that space between them for us is two-dimensional, but for RF signal is actually not, and there is particular in transverse to magnetic mode, as CM mode. It's important that this antenna has extremely big Q factor, which is 20 to 2000, and high permittivity, and to FGM.
Well, that high Q factor is going to make it a very, 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 very narrow bandwidth. Just as I say, you know, I mean, historically, transmission lines have been turned into radiators. You mentioned the coax cables that have little puncture marks in them that allow, that are used in subway tunnels that operate as partial leaky transmission lines that also radiate the signal to people who need to use that signal in the tunnel.
We're talking about a cell phone that is using one particular frequency in one particular frequency to the cell, then IQ is actually something that is negative. You know, it can be excited in different techniques, but interesting. Do you know the way of antenna, especially the ray, no moving
Well, unfortunately, we're having that microphone problem again, so I'm not quite sure what the question was.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
You're breaking up a little bit.
Can you hear me?
Again, you're breaking up in the middle of that.
Can you hear me now?
Somewhat, I'd say about 80%.
The radio antenna.